Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. What's the connection between the St. Louis Zoo and efforts to protect endangered species in Africa? We'll be talking about that a little bit later in the program. But first, something that has been talked about a lot since 9/11, how Muslim women fare in the Islamic world. We hear how they are relegated to a second-class, largely powerless status. They are denied education, independence, employment, and much more. Is that a fair characterization? Our first guest on today's program, Dr. Minaz Afridi, teaches courses on Islam, Judaism, women and religion, world religions, genocide studies, and Arab and Israeli literature at Manhattan College. She has special interest in contemporary Islam and gender issues in the Islamic world. She's here for a presentation this evening for the Lee Institute Speakers Series. Professor, nice to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me here, Don.
That's quite a portfolio. You cover a lot of ground in your teaching.
I do. I'm one of those polyglot academics.
Well, it's an interesting area, the entire area that you cover. Let me ask you, is the picture that we have of women in the Islamic world an accurate portrayal, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that, you mentioned 9/11. I think that the portrayal of Muslim women around the time of 9/11 and post-9/11 became even more extreme in terms of being oppressed, being backward, being relegated as second-class citizens, being violent, having a lot of domestic violence, and also having absolutely no rights, which is not completely incorrect in terms of the Muslim world, but it also relied heavily on the religion of Islam. And so we need to deconstruct those misperceptions. We need to understand what Islam says. We need to look at different cultures, and we have to also diversify who Muslim women are in the world today. And I think that's the most important thing to do. And tonight, that is part of what I'm going to do, is to clarify those perceptions, talk about the Quran, and talk about patriarchy and misogyny that we are all dealing with in all different traditions all over the world.
Now, I gather it's not a homogenous group, that they have played different roles in different countries, for instance.
Absolutely. I mean, you have Muslims in China, you have Muslims in Pakistan, you have Muslims in Bosnia, you have Muslims in Europe, you have Muslims in Africa, you have Muslims in America. So these are all different women living in different patriarchal structures, but also in terms of cultural structures that have a tradition rather than an Islamic tradition. So, for example, a woman in Pakistan has different rights than a woman in Morocco. A woman in Morocco has different rights than a woman in Saudi Arabia. A woman in Saudi Arabia has different rights than a woman in Yemen. So these are very important things for us to understand, and we are quite widespread. We are 1.5 billion people in the world today.
I think many people in this country, because of all the publicity since 9/11, tend to think that all women in the Islamic world are treated the way the Taliban would treat women.
Well, you know, as a Pakistani Muslim woman, I want to say the Taliban must take a refresher course in Islam. And if I could give them a course, I'd be happy to. But tonight, you know, I will talk about the case of Malala Yousafzai and also the case of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, two very different case studies of two different women that have become sensations for different reasons. And I think we need to look at what happened in the lives of these women, what they understand about the Quran, what they take from the Quran, what they reject about the Quran. So one of the reasons that it's important to talk about Muslim women is that we are the future of most Muslim countries. If you look at what's going on the ground in many, many of these countries, including Egypt and Tunisia and Pakistan, a lot of women are working on the ground to change things and to change the internal structures of those countries.
What does the Quran say? I mean, obviously the Taliban, if I can just use that reference one more time, reads it and sees it differently than is the case in other places.
Well, I mean, I want to say that the Taliban and you and I could read the Quran and see it very differently. You know, we have a tradition in our religion, Islamic tradition, that talks about ijtihad, which is interpretation of the Quran. We talk about Sharia in this country as if it's a fixed law, but indeed it is not. There must be an ijma or a consensus of scholars that come up with different edicts on different fatwas, legal opinions on what happens. The Taliban reads the Quran literally and reads it for itself. For example, the Taliban says women cannot get educated. Women and men are given complete access, equal knowledge to anything in the world, and both are culpable in terms of the eyes of God. So I could read the Quran, or I could read the Torah, or I could read the Bible very literally and say, well, you know, these are very violent texts. They're very, very violent. And also the Bible is very violent in terms of women. But what can we do with these texts? How can we contextualize them? How can we talk about them in terms of what's going on in the world? But also the main message of the Quran is about Islamic justice. It's about principles of egalitarianism. It's about human rights. And we have lost that along the way because of patriarchy and men being in charge of interpretation. Recently in the New York Times, where I live, I saw in the book review section an article on art. What do people like to see in the Metropolitan Museum of Art? They like to see art done by men. Now, we're talking about 2014 of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Mm-hmm. So patriarchy is not just an issue in Muslim countries. It's an issue everywhere. It's how we are going to handle the interpretation of our religion and put that in laws. That's very important.
Oh, and reading about you, a word that I see popping up again and again, and you used it a couple of times, is misinterpretation. This is key to your thinking.
Absolutely. Misinterpretation is to really look at a religion that has a lot of richness, a lot of history, a lot of art, ideas, and also women that were very powerful, even in early Islam. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, his first wife was a businesswoman. She owned real estate. His youngest wife, who was 18 when he passed on, was a person who interpreted texts. We've forgotten these lessons, and we've let sort of a system take over where we need to sort of look at the interpretation of Islam and the Quran and especially women's rights. And it is happening. There are a lot of scholars in the United States and all over the world that are trying to reinterpret what's going on. But I will also argue as a Muslim that if you want to see something negative, you will see it in the Quran. If you want to see something positive, you see it in the Quran. There is also responsibility of religious people all over the world to accept that there are problems of sacred texts, that there are problems within our culture, that we have to be self-critical in order to move together as a community.
You know, we have to point out that you can also read the Bible and interpret things in many different ways.
Absolutely,
it's not specific to the Quran. You know, the thing that you would like to do, the path that you would like to take, and the changes you would like to see, and they're not going to happen overnight. I mean, they're not going to happen probably in our lifetime. What sense do you have as to how to go about this change in a way that will affect something meaningful?
I mean, one of the interesting cases has been about Malala Yousafzai.
For those who have forgotten, and I hope nobody has, this young woman who was shot in the face by the Taliban and survived and became a heroic figure.
Mm-hmm. And she spoke in front of the UN Assembly about education and how education should be a weapon, instead of a gun.
I mean, she was shot because she was a student.
Yes. Correct. And they also wanted to kill her father, mm-hmm. who is a progressive Muslim. He's also from the Pathan tribe, which is also my tribe, and they're from the Swat Valley. Now, what's interesting about her is that she's become sort of an icon, and a lot of people felt, even in Pakistan, a resentment towards that because they felt that she had become a Western icon. But, you know, I'm against that. We are not East and West. We are together. We are together in the fight for human rights. I think that we have to move together, whether it's Pakistan and America, whether it's people of human rights. We should stop this nonsensical idea, this kind of imagination we have about East and West being completely separate. We are really a global community today. You can go to any part of the Muslim world and see globalization. You can see Americanism. You can see English. You can see all kinds of infiltration. And you can see that here in the United States. A lot of cultures are coming through. So when we start thinking of, say, the case of Malala as being separate, then it becomes problematic. But there are many, many institutions in many places that are doing long-term development for women, whether it's education, whether it's a home for them, whether it's placement, whether it's college or education. there is no overnight solution, but solutions are there. And one step at a time can create a lot of great solutions for one girl at a time.
But, you know, in this global community, as you put it, what we also see are drones, and we see military troops, and we see bloodshed, we see innocence, we see, children dying on roadways because of exploding bombs. This is not a way to bring people together.
No, it's not. And, you know, Don, you may know this about my profile. I mean, I teach genocide. And mm-hmm. I teach Holocaust studies. And for me to still be talking about Darfur and, you know, talking about Bosnia and talking about Rwanda is very disheartening. but, you know, we have to keep things in perspective. Mm. If we are completely defeated by the ugliness and the disaster of war and the killing of each other, then we can never have a voice. If we sit paralyzed, especially in the Muslim world, we are not victims. We have to move quick and we have to move fast and we have to speak out against these drone attacks. We have to speak out against militarism. But that has a lot to do with having the freedom to do that as women and as well as men.
Who is speaking out? Who is speaking out in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and you name any other country you choose?
Well, I mean, you know, I live in a beautiful world where I see a lot of people speaking out. And maybe that's the world I live in. I don't necessarily always live in, you know, CNN and Fox world. But I live in a world where you can really see women in those territories speaking out and working for the cause of law, even under the Taliban. I see people in Pakistan talking about how the drone attacks are really affecting the relationship between Pakistan and the USA. So there are people who are speaking out.
Are they women?
A lot of them are women, mm-hmm. yes, and a lot of them are men. So we have to keep things in perspective. If we in America are going to sit here as Americans and say, you know, women are really oppressed in the Muslim world, we have to understand where that perception comes from and what we're doing to stop the kind of communication we could have with these women and Pakistanis in terms of being Americans.
Right. I have to take a break now. My guest is Professor Minaz Afridi. She is from Manhattan College, and she is here tonight to speak as part of the Lee Institute Speaker Series. That's going to be happening at the Ladue Chapel at 7:30 tonight. That's the Ladue Chapel Presbyterian Church at 9450 Clayton Road. Back to continue our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to get into it, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We'll take an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd prefer to send us a tweet, do so at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Professor Minaz Afridi in just a moment. We're talking about women in the Islamic world and the role that they play. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Missouri Senate may consider legislation tonight that would gradually cut the state's income tax rate by one half of a percentage point beginning in 2017. The bill is a priority for Republicans, but Democratic Governor Jay Nixon has already indicated his opposition to it. And the fight over the Take Back St. Louis ballot initiative was back in court today. The charter amendment would bar the city of St. Louis from offering incentives to companies such as Peabody Energy that extract non-renewable resources. It would also prevent companies that do business with certain energy providers from getting tax breaks. Today's hearing focused on whether to make permanent a preliminary injunction, knocking the measure off the April ballot. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to Professor Afridi. You know, I think a lot of people might be taken somewhat aback by the range of your studies and your interests. The Holocaust, for instance, as a Muslim woman, I don't imagine there are a great many that take a particular interest in that and the genocide of the Holocaust. What drew you in that direction?
Well, I mean, Don, I had a kind of wonderfully enchanting upbringing in Europe and the Middle East, and I was always raised with Jews and Christians around me. And then when I would ask about Israel or Jerusalem, there would always be a hesitation. And then when I moved to the Middle East, Dubai, I was at a school there, a wonderful school, where they would blot out the word Israel and Jew from my history books. And then 3 years after being there, I moved to Scarsdale, New York, which is a heavily Jewish American community and school, where I was kicked in the shin for being a Muslim woman. So I was clearly very confused about what was going on, but not dissuaded by having conversations and dialogue. And then when I went to Syracuse University, I took a class in post-Holocaust studies and actually was a teaching assistant for a professor there, and just completely blew my mind in terms of World War II history and what had happened to the Jews. But then as I grew older and started to study Islam and comparative religion, I recognized that there was a sort of dismissal of the Holocaust in the Muslim world, and I wanted to do something about it. I also wanted to do something about anti-Semitism in the Muslim world. I feel that as a Muslim, we have to speak out for justice. And if we even hear false rumors from our parents or our family, we must speak out in the name of truth. And so I took it upon myself to write a book, which is coming out in September 15th, called Shoah Through Muslim Eyes. And it's about my journey, about the Holocaust, about anti-Semitism. And I also interviewed Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. I think for us as Muslims to move forward, we have to recognize each other's pain and suffering at different times, at different moments historically. We have had our pain. We have had colonization. We are going through transition. And we have to also recognize other people's pain rather than politicizing it in terms of Israel and Palestine all the time. So I think this is a move forward for reconciliation. It's a move where suffering is acknowledged by two very sometimes tense communities, Jews and Muslims.
I think it's so often that people don't recognize that the great religions, the root of the great religions, is the same.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, we are cousins. If you look at Abraham, if you look at our journeys together, if you look at how Jews and Muslims work together in places like Baghdad, translated texts from Greek into Arabic. I mean, there was just an incredible renaissance that Jews and Muslims had together. There were also problems. I mean, there is no whitewashing in terms of history, but we are human. We are human. We err. We make mistakes. But we can't forget each other's suffering, whether it was ours or done by somebody else. And I think that's a very important part and the lesson of being religious, but also being in a religious community.
Plenty of suffering to go around.
Yes.
over the years. And let's take a call. Gooder is joining us from St. Louis. I hope I have the name pronounced correctly. Gooder, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, it is, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great.
Your guest admitted that the texts in the books are violent and violence. And my understanding, though, is if you don't follow the books correctly and you're not a true Muslim or a Christian, I was a former Muslim. I'm a total atheist right now. And I think religion divides us. And the only solution for our problems in the world is atheism, you know, abandonment of religion totally. And that's it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for that call. You know, there was a time in my life when I became a nihilist. I don't know if you know what that is, but that is even a beyond an atheist. And I think there's different journeys we take in our lives to understand ourselves and our faith. I think violence is going to be there in human beings. I mean, I tell my students in all my classes that religion will not knock at your door and say, hello, can I come in? We are creating religious edicts, religious philosophies. We are the ones responsible for the violence. One of the things that you say is that Christians and Jews and Muslims have violence in their texts. Yes, they do. I mean, you can find some in the Jewish texts, for example, in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. But when you take that literally, you are taking something that you could take an ad literary or marketing literary. So you have to look at yourself in terms of faith and not just the literal interpretation of religion. If you think atheism is the answer, well, that's fine too. You know, there are many, many hadiths that talk about Prophet Muhammad talking about how people practice and don't practice, but it doesn't mean they're not good people. You can be a moral and just people and also be an atheist. However, if that atheism comes from not wanting violence in your religion, even God may forgive you and love you for that.
How do you explain the fact, then, that some of the most horrific violence ever recorded in world history is done in the name of religion?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I study the Holocaust, and I mean, if you say that the Nazis were religious or Hitler was religious, I mean, that's pretty bad. I study Stalin. Stalin was not a religious man.
We can go to the Crusades, and we can go to many of the wars that were fought on religious lines.
Right, and I mean, the Crusades, I mean, I think a lot of my my community at Manhattan College would say Crusades is not the literal interpretation of the Bible. This is not the way to go. I think that, you know, one of the ways that we use violence, I mean, we've used that even in terms of looking at Bosnia, how Serbian Orthodox used violence against Bosnian Muslims, that they didn't recognize, you know, Christ. It was the same kind of liability that were put on Jews during the Holocaust. So you can twist and turn. But again, one of the things is that we can use anything. I can use ideology. I can use democracy. I can use communism. I can use Islamicism, you know, and Islamicists who are extremists. Or I could use fundamental Christians to come up with a plan that I wanted to come up with. Religion is used, again, it's the same very simple fine line. Is it something that you are using to kill, to violate, to justify something? What is your relationship with God? How do you see God? Is God a person that believes in Jews, Christians, Muslims, and others? Or is God only yours? How do you possess God? I mean, the Buddhists would say we have too much of an ego in the Abrahamic faith. We should, you know, sort of look at ourselves and say, what's going on in terms of understanding who we are?
Yeah. You mentioned Malala a little while ago and the fact that you're bringing her into your discussion tonight. There is also another person, and I want to be sure I have the name, is Ayaan Hirsi Ali.
That's correct.
Will be also part of that discussion. She is coming into St. Louis, I believe.
I hear, yes.
Yeah, so yes. We'll look forward to that. But for the sake of our audience, tell us how you bring her into the equation.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali is somebody that I think a lot of people have been following. Her memoir, Infidel, had a huge sensation in the United States. And a lot of people started thinking of Muslim women all over represented by Ayaan Hirsi Ali. So I want to sort of, again, deconstruct those stereotypes and say not all Muslim women are like her. She's led kind of a very sad life, I think. I feel empathy towards her. However, she has condemned Islam in the Quran. And I think what happened to her after 9/11 was she looked for Osama bin Laden's own verses in the Quran, and she found them, literally. So I think I want to talk about that because it's a complex thing. Just like the last caller was asking about, you know, religion and sacred texts. It's important for us to see different cases of Muslim women. Ayaan Hirsi Ali today, she had claimed that she was an atheist, but has become a Christian.
She's Somali-born, correct?
Yes, she is Somali-born. Yeah. And it's a very different story, being from Somalia or being from Pakistan. That's one of the things I want to show. But I also want to show what happens to women. One of the critiques I would have for American media is how they focus on very angry women at their own religion as Muslims. They don't focus on people like me. I mean, I like being a Muslim. I don't feel oppressed as a Muslim woman. I feel freedom. I feel there are challenges and struggles every day. I ask myself lots of questions about what goes on in either the place of my birth or here in America. But the focus has always been on people like Ayaan Hirsi Ali or on Malala, who was shot, or on Wafa al-Sultan, who is again, left Islam and talks about Islam as being a violent religion. Why don't we have some really, really, really positive voices for a change?
Well, you can make that case, you know, in so many different areas. Needless to say, the way the media approaches these things, I think, for instance, again, basically since 9/11, we hear words like fatwa, which you used a little while ago, and jihad. We don't understand what those things mean. We hear about 40 virgins and the suicide bombers and all the rest of it. That's what we get. That's our diet of information about the Muslim world, the Islamic world.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the diet is not so different. For example, I argue in my book on Shoah Through Muslim Eyes that we have the same perceptions of Jews. We've taken the European old anti-Semitic perceptions and implicated them in the Arab and Muslim world. The Jews control the world. They have the lobby in Congress. You know, they're always trying to conspire against Muslims. These are, again, diet prescriptions, right? Mm. This is if you believe in this, and then you believe in Judaism. Mm. So it goes both ways. And it becomes problematic because we don't take the time to understand, to look at people in different communities in diverse ways. So not all Jews are the same. Not all Israelis are the same. Not all Muslims are the same. Not all Palestinians are the same. And this is my message, whether it's through women, whether it's through human rights. And that needs to be at the forefront. But do we have time to sit down and read texts, religious texts? Do we have time to take classes on religion? It's up to us to be that educated.
Right. What has the response been? We have to wrap this part of the program up. But what has the response been, do you think, to your message? I mean, clearly you're traveling the country when your schedule allows. Do you find that there is a positive response to you?
I think that there are two different things I do. One is talk about Islam and the perceptions of Islam. And the second thing I do is talk about anti-Semitism in the Muslim world. I think both have had positive reactions. I think people want to hear Muslim women open up and say, look, we have issues, but this is who we really are, or we really are becoming, or this is what you're not hearing in the media. And I think that's a really important thing for everyone to hear, whether it's a Christian woman, a Jewish woman, Buddhist, Hindu, etc.
And someone's got to do it, and you're one of those someones. I hope there are many more like you out there. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you so much, Don.
The Lee Institute Speaker Series presents Manaz Afridi on contemporary issues of Muslim woman tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the Ladue Chapel. Go there and you'll hear more about the kinds of things that we were talking about here today. Professor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
When we come back, efforts to protect endangered species in Africa and the St. Louis Connection. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.